Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are going to be four people at the witness table tomorrow in front of the Senate Banking Committee, the CEOs of Detroit's Big Three, and this guy.
If a UAW membership went in these facilities and worked for nothing, according to our research department, it would not help the companies that much.
Obviously, they're not going to do that, but the head of the United Auto Workers said today they will do what they can to keep Detroit in business. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by Constant Contact, the email marketing service dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 3rd of December. Great to have you with us, as always. Car makers are going to get a second bite at the bailout apple tomorrow in Washington. They're asking for about $34 billion in loan guarantees and lines of credit, sooner rather than later, too. GM says it needs $4 billion just to make it to New Year's. At an emergency meeting today, the United Auto Workers Union decided to try to help car makers make their case. From Washington Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Top UAW officials huddled in Detroit today. UAW President Ron Gettelfinger emerged from the meeting with two concessions, a delay in the automaker's payments to a union-run health care trust, and scaling back a jobs bank that pays laid-off workers' salaries and benefits. But Gettelfinger said the union is not reopening contract negotiations.
We're not opening the contract, if you will. We make modifications, but then we take them back to the membership.
Still, after today's concessions, Detroit's Big Three will be able to put off billions of dollars in payments to the health care trust. It will eventually assume some health care costs. Dave Cole heads the Center for Automotive Research. He says the Jobs Bank concession is an important response to lawmakers. They criticized auto executives last month for paying idle workers.
So it's been this visible example of what people have felt is an abuse of labor. And so the elimination of that symbolically, I think, is very important.
Jessica Caldwell is an auto industry analyst with Edmunds.com. She says it's hard to estimate how much the union concessions will save, but
it's not going to be anywhere near what GM, Ford, and Chrysler need to move forward and to become, you know, in the black and get out of the red. But, you know, it's a good start.
Caldwell says the automakers will still need a jumpstart from Congress, a message the auto executives and union will drive home in congressional hearings tomorrow and Friday. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
As Ford, GM, and Chrysler go hat in hand to Congress asking for help, their CEOs now say they will take just a dollar a year in salary if that'll make things better. But Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports the bucks don't really stop there.
There are plenty of CEOs who take home just a dollar a year in salary. Steve Jobs at Apple, Eric Schmidt at Google, and John Mackey at Whole Foods, to name a few. But it's not easy to find one who gets no additional compensation.
No, that doesn't happen.
Alexandra Higgins with the Corporate Library says when you add it all up, the perks, the bonuses, the restricted stocks, the stock options, getting rid of a salary just isn't all that big a deal.
The only thing it does is remove a guaranteed payment.
Tom LaWare at the consulting firm Compensia says there are two main reasons CEOs decide to take a dollar a year. Either they started their company, like Apple's Steve Jobs, and already own so much of it that growth is far more important than compensation, or, says LaWare, their company is collapsing, as in the case of the automakers.
Obviously, some of it is probably publicity, but you have to make a strong statement at the top.
He says the CEOs of GM, Ford, and Chrysler may not have the same safety net as other CEOs. Their stock options ain't what they used to be.
So for this next year or two, that dollar a year could be most of their compensation.
I guess it beats unemployment. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Once upon a time, it took a couple of million dollars to open an account at one of the most prestigious investment banks in America. Today, there is word that Goldman Sachs might soon be scouring the internet looking to raise some quick cash. Just a couple of months ago, the Wall Street powerhouse decided the investment banking model wasn't such a good idea anymore. So it turned itself into a full-service operation. That allows it to go after deposits. And today, the Wall Street Journal reported Goldman soon could become an internet banking startup. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
When you're faced with insufficient funds, you need to beef up your deposits fast. But some Wall Street analysts were shaking their heads skeptically over the idea the world's premier investment bank might be considering hitting the internet with hat in hand. Howard Davidowitz is a retail consultant in New York.
This is a company that deals at the highest levels with America's largest corporations in the most sensitive sorts of deals with the wealthiest people in the world. I don't see how this enhances their brand.
If they want to do that, then they might as well start selling stamps online, too.
Investment advisor John Ogg is a commentator for the financial analysis website 24/7 Wall Street. He says trying to stick just a toe in the water with an online-only banking operation would be no substitute for having neighborhood branches.
What's the easiest way to go scoop up a ton of deposits right now? It's not by flooding the internet with applications for an online bank. It's by going out and acquiring physical deposits that are out there.
Richard Speer agrees. He heads an Atlanta consulting firm that specializes in electronic banking.
There's no shortage of internet banking offerings. In general, most of those have been very successful in attracting high-rate deposits. They have not been successful in building relationships.
Speer calls Goldman Sachs a highly intelligent operation, smart enough, he says, to figure out that online banking by itself isn't enough. Then again, it's hard to imagine such a prestigious institution offering toasters. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Investment banking might have its downside as a career these days, given the layoffs, but at least it's reasonably safe in a physical sense. Military service, on the other hand, is dangerous, but it's a job. The Pentagon is seeing some of its best recruiting figures in years as the economy heads south. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
A few years ago, when military recruiters struggled to meet enlistment goals, the Pentagon relaxed some requirements and sweetened the pot financially, increasing bonuses for signing up and staying in the military. National security analyst Mackenzie Eaglin is with the Heritage Foundation.
Even the pay to deploy overseas is quite considerable. So there's no doubt that there is a direct correlation between a downturn in the civilian economy and a relationship to recruiting increasing for the military.
2008 has been good for recruiters. All branches met their enlistment goals. And except for the Air Force, the number of folks re-enlisting is also up.
So whenever unemployment is high, recruiters have a much easier time meeting their monthly quotas.
That's Rick Johncow with the Project on Youth and Non-Military Opportunities. He tries to present young people with financial alternatives to joining the military.
I think that for most young people who are considering enlistment, it really is the bread and butter issues that's motivating them.
That's also an issue for those considering leaving the military. For one thing, those lucrative contracting jobs don't have a bright future. Again, Mackenzie Eaglin.
Obama, as a candidate, specifically campaigned on one point, noting that he would reduce the U.S. military's reliance upon contractors in combat.
With an estimated 100,000 contractors working in Iraq alongside American soldiers, those jobs won't disappear overnight. But no matter how much contractors pay, they can't hold a candle to the military in terms of job security. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Today was one of those days where the markets just make you shake your head and say, what? Ever. The economic news was lousy. The music will be happy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Drug companies spend a lot of time and money trying to convince doctors to prescribe their products. That's not in and of itself a problem. It's called marketing, right? When there's a personal financial relationship, though, it's another question. A physician's endorsement can help turn a pill into a blockbuster. But what if that's at the expense of some kind of alternative treatment and the patient never knows about the financial relationship? Today, the Cleveland Clinic announced it's going to disclose its doctors' ties to the drug industry up front. Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
In the Find a Doctor section of the Cleveland Clinic's website, Dr. Mercedes Dillam is listed as a cardiac surgeon. I can review her photo, bio, and now find out that she has a partnership with a medical device company called Cormatrix. Not that there's anything wrong with that, says the Cleveland Clinic's Guy Chisholm.
Partnerships with industry are not evil, and they're not all bad, and they're not all prejudicial. But you want to do these partnerships ethically, and you want to do them where you eliminate bias.
Bias issues between doctors and the drug industry have come to a head this year. A congressional inquiry found that some physicians were making millions reviewing drug trials. They failed to reveal that they were being paid by the drug companies. But T. Rowe Price analyst Jay Markowitz says it is possible to get paid and still be objective.
I don't view the kind of payment for time and services as a bribe to lie about the risks and benefits of a treatment.
Still, studies have shown that company-sponsored research is more likely to produce positive results. David Hamilton at BNet.com says it's just human nature.
If somebody gives you a lot of money, even if it's to support your research, even if you're not benefiting personally from it, you start thinking of them more as, you know, friends than as people you're doing business with.
Disclosure may be the first step in treating medical conflicts of interest. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The global economic slowdown has taken all the suspense out of covering central bank meetings. You used to actually have to keep an eye on them to see whether they cut interest rates or they raised them. Now the question here is when, not whether Ben Bernanke is going to lower the federal funds rate down to zero. Rates aren't quite that low over in the UK, but they are dropping all the time. The Bank of England meets tomorrow, almost certainly to cut again. Last month, the bank dropped its rate to 3%. That's the lowest it's been in more than 50 years. Another cut will help hard-pressed borrowers over there. But there is another group of Brits that isn't going to be applauding. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been talking to hard-pressed savers.
Christopher Barton is organizing a petition calling on the UK authorities, in his words, to consider the plight of prudent savers. He's one of them, a 59-year-old retired manager. Here he is online, checking the rate of return on his savings.
Oh dear, look at this. It's come right down again. Right down. So
he has his money in a savings account. He and his wife live mostly off the interest. The recent drop in UK interest rates has cut their retirement income in half, and further rate cuts are likely on the way.
It will have quite a dramatic effect on our way of life. We'll be able to live. Hopefully, as long as they don't go down to zero or something ridiculous. But it won't allow for any luxuries, and we'll just have to be extremely careful.
Hundreds of thousands of British retirees depend on interest for at least some of their income. And low interest rates not only affect the return on savings, they reduce the income generated by many pension plans. Malcolm McLean is a pensions advisor.
We're finding a lot of people are coming to us quite dismayed at the large reductions and deciding that the only thing they can do is to stay on at work.
Economists say the UK central bank has got to cut rates and cut them hard. They say that saving is not a virtue in a severe downturn, that we need people to borrow and spend to rescue the ailing economy. That does not console Christopher Barton. He says it was borrowers, not savers, that caused the crisis.
Basically, there are a lot of people out there who have been prudent and now they've got no reward. No reward for their prudence, no reward for their savings, and are basically forgotten.
He says he launched his petition as a protest, but he ruefully acknowledges it will have little effect. The Bank of England is expected to cut rates by an extra half a point tomorrow. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, trying to look good in tough times.
With the beauty market, it's not quite as simple as supply and demand.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials advanced 172 points today, and even 2% to close at 8,591. The Nasdaq climbed 42 points, nearly 3% there, finished at 1,492. The S&P 500 rose 21 points, more than 2.5%. wrapped up the trading day at 870. The holiday season was looking a little rosier for retailers, according to one forecast, and that gave the sector a much-needed lift. Amazon surged 9.75%. Target rang up a gain of more than 9%. JCPenney cashed in more than 6%. Walmart stores picked up 1.75% today. A record increase in mortgage applications helped build up stock in Pulte Homes by more than 13%. Bond prices edged higher. That nudged the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.65%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. By Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat, now available at splendidtable.org. And by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at Gather.com. What's the connection between Girl Scout cookies and margin calls? Check out the Marketplace Decoder on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department releases factory orders for October. Chain stores are scheduled to report sales figures for November. Most malls are open around the clock at some point during the holidays. That's according to the International Council of Shopping Centers. And Keep America Beautiful, those folks who tell us not to litter, continues its national conference in Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Not only is higher education in this country getting more expensive, much like Detroit, it's not keeping up with foreign competition either. A study out today from the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education says tuition is rising faster than family incomes. More kids are dropping out of high school. And the U.S. is falling behind because other countries are better at getting their young people into and through college. Back home, meanwhile, bailouts continue as money pours in to fix our troubled financial markets. Commentator Robert Reich says that's great for now, but we do need to keep our eye on the long-term ball.
Our preoccupation with the immediate crisis of financial capital is causing us to overlook the bigger crisis in America's human capital. While we commit hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars to Wall Street, we're slashing our outlays for public education. Education is largely funded by state and local governments, whose revenues are plummeting. As consumers cut back, state sales taxes are shrinking, and as home values decline, local property taxes are taking a hit. Three-quarters of our states are facing budget crises. As a result, schools are being closed, teachers laid off, after-school programs cut, so-called non-critical subjects like history eliminated, and tuitions hiked at state colleges. It's absurd. We're bailing out every major bank to get financial capital flowing again, but we're squeezing the main sources of our human capital. Yet the future competitiveness and standard of living of America depend on our people's skills, their capacities to communicate and solve problems and innovate, not their ability to borrow money. What's more, human capital is rooted here, while financial capital moves around the globe at the speed of an electronic blip. Right now, global capital markets are frozen, but the big money, mostly in Asia and the Middle East, will come back here eventually, bailout or no bailout. It's our human capital that's in short supply, and without adequate public funding, the supply will shrink further. Now, I'm not saying funding is everything, but without it, we can't attract talented people into teaching, keep classrooms small, and give our kids a well-rounded curriculum, and ensure that every qualified young person can go to college. So why are we bailing out Wall Street and not our nation's public schools and colleges? Partly because the crisis in financial capital is immediate, while our capital crisis is unfolding gradually. But maybe it's also because we don't have a central banker for America's human capital, someone who warns us as loudly as Ben Bernanke did a few months ago of dire consequences if we don't come up with the dough.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Supercapitalism. Drop us a line with your thoughts about what you hear on the program. Our website is marketplace.org. I'm wearing blue jeans and a wrinkled button-down shirt right now, which is fine because, well, A, this is radio, and B, it's not like anybody's going to look to me for fashion tips. Not so, though, for the woman whose husband just won the White House. Michelle Obama's clothes started to get a whole lot of attention this past summer, and there is now big buzz about who's going to dress her for the inauguration. To help figure out what that might mean for clothing retailers, we've called Kate Betts. She is the editor-in-chief of Time, Style, and Design. Kate, good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Give us the layman's version, since I am a fashion layman, of Michelle Obama's style.
Well, I think she has very chic, very grown-up, very American style. She loves color. She loves prints. She loves to support young American designers, which I think is fantastic. I think she also appreciates value, which is something that the whole consumer public can appreciate right now. She wore that White House black market dress on The View. It was a $148 dress, and it was great looking. And she also wore J. Crew a few times, and people identify with that.
And J. Crew, in fact, sets up its own page on the website devoted to Michelle Obama's style, right?
I think they responded very quickly to that. Yeah. And I heard that they had a lot of customer response to that. So.
I bet they did. Let's take this to the higher end, though. The inaugural balls are coming up, the inauguration itself. How heavy is the frenzy to dress this woman for all these big parties?
Well, I think the people who are probably being seriously considered are being quite low-key about it. And I think some of the designers that she has preferred in the past, like Narciso Rodriguez, Takun Panichgul, who goes under the label of just Takun, I'm sure that they are whipping stuff up for her, but they're not talking about it too much. So,
what would that translate into, though, in terms of sales for these designers and, more importantly, down the fashion food chain? How would that work?
Sales for designers, it probably is very important for them also in terms of exposure. Both of those designers I mentioned before are, you know, they're well known, but, you know, this gives them real international exposure. And I think that down the food chain, I think it's something that people will pick up on. Hopefully people will embrace her clean, chic look that's quite optimistic, I think.
Is there a chance that this could be sort of a retail bright spot in an otherwise, you know, down economy?
Yeah, I think it's a great thing for retail. I think all the little gestures that she does when she appears in public, like early on when she was wearing a lot of brooches and she talked about it, I think that helps a lot. It gives people the confidence to go out and go shopping. It gives people the confidence to try something new with their look. And both of those things are strongly needed right now.
Just in the interest of equal time here, what do you think about how her husband dresses?
I think her husband looks great.
All right.
I don't think he should change a thing.
All right. Kate Betts is the editor-in-chief of Time, Style, and Design. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Fashion's really only part of the style equation, because to really look good in clothes, you have to look good. For men, that can be, I don't know, a good shave and combing your hair. For women, it gets more complicated. While they might cut back on new clothes and accessories in a recession, it's a different story when it comes to highlights and facials. Women, and they are mostly women, probably aren't going to give up personal primping entirely, but they are taking a breather, and that has salons scrambling to adjust to beauty's new bottom line. Marketplace's Renita Jablonski reports.
Full disclosure, it's been 5 months. It has been 5 months since I've trimmed my hair and had my highlights touched up. Stylists tell you to come in every 6 weeks. I've been trying to save money. Who isn't?
I'm not running in every 6 weeks. Sometimes it's seven, sometimes it's eight, but I'm still coming.
That's Leslie Halpern. I met her while she was getting the works at an L.A. salon called B2V. She lost her job as a creative director for a furniture company a year ago, but every few months she still comes to B2V and drops about $275 on a haircut and color.
There are certain things I can do at home to alleviate expenses. I can give myself a manicure. I'm not going to color my hair at home. I don't want the mess. I don't have the chops for that. And I'm not going to live without it.
Halpern says she needs to spend money on her looks if she wants potential employers to look at her. It's that kind of thinking that's helping the vanity industry survive in this not-so-pretty economy, says Kat Fay. She's a beauty industry analyst at Mintel International.
With the beauty market, it's not quite as simple as supply and demand.
She says there's a lot of emotion involved when it comes to spending on personal appearance. Steve Lococo co-owns B2V and another salon in Beverly Hills. He says business is down about 10% as more clients waited out.
They've sort of quietly and gently suggested that they might not be coming in as often.
So Lococo's team is trying to add some style to saving. The salon now offers a monthly blow-drying class for $20. A blowout at the salon runs between $50 and $70. Lococo says he expects a decent December since clients usually splurge on a new do for the holidays. The bigger tests will come after the party season ends.
We have to make sure that we keep them in the salon January and February, and that's what we're working with our staff right now to do.
Vicky Vargas has a different challenge. Vargas manages two Supercuts franchises in L.A. Her business is growing so fast, she's had to hire more stylists.
We've got a lot of customers that are used to going to a more expensive salon and want to try Supercuts because it's more affordable.
You can get a haircut here for $16. Panita Khanna came in because her son needed a cut. Now she's thinking of making the switch to Supercuts herself. Khanna says she gave her beauty treatments the treatment after the last quarterly report from her broker.
Oh, dear. Well, I've decreased the number of facials. I got rid of my trainer a couple months ago, which I'm glad I did. Decreased spa visits. Decreased my shopping habit.
Khanna says those adjustments will mean an extra $5,000 to $10,000 over a year. As for me, I'm going to give it a few more weeks before I make that hair appointment. Dark roots are in the season. I swear I heard that somewhere. In Los Angeles, I'm Renita Jablonski for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, proof that nickels and dimes really can add up. Tomorrow, Chicago Mayor Richard Daley is going to present the city council with a plan that he says will add $1.2 billion to the city's bank account by leasing Chicago's parking meters to a private contractor. There are 36,000 metered spaces in the Windy City. Daley says that a lease will run 75 years, but he'll get the money up front and use it to backstop city finances. About the only losers are going to be people actually using the meters. Hourly rates downtown are going to jump to as much as $6.50 within 5 years. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 172 points. That is 2%. The NASDAQ increased 42 points, 2.9%. The S&P 500 added 21 points, 2.6%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewertz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, an economist reminds us to look beyond Wall Street and Main Street.
The vulnerable are part of the society. Secondly, they're part of the society who often don't get their attention. I mean, even in the rescue packages, the concentration has been so much on bailing out the relatively more prosperous.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.